You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
Okay. We're on the podcast Something Rather Than Nothing, and it is wonderful to have Seamus Murphy, photographer and director, with us. And he's had some incredible books which display his images and photographs. One is called A Darkness Visible, Afghanistan. Also another collaboration with Polly Jean Harvey called The Hollow of the Hand. The Republic, which covers his homeland, Ireland. And I Am the Beggar of the World with Eliza Griswold, and which includes his images with some Landai poetry. In addition to those printed works, he has films including the videos for Polly Jean Harvey's Let England Shake, and some other short films, and a more recent one called A Dog Called Money. I wanted to welcome you, Seamus, to the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
The first question I ask guests is, what were you like as a young child?
A monster. No, I wasn't. I guess I was an average kid. You know, I grew up in Dublin in the 60s, 70s. And I think I was one of six kids, and I was the youngest. And I think it was benign neglect, I think they call it. You know, my parents were very loving, but they let us get on with things. So when I look back on it, it was glorious in many ways. You know, we were able to sort of, you know, we lived in the city of Dublin, and we were able to sort of be on the street, and it wasn't worrying too much about the dangers that are out there now. And you know, I played football a lot. Football was my thing, and as a kid. And how would I describe myself? I think just sort of, yeah, average little what they call in Dublin a little gurrier, which is, it comes from the French, guerre, you know, like war, warrior.
Right, right.
It's not a good thing to say about somebody, but people use it affectionately. So a little Dublin gurrier. Yeah.
So did you...
Up to mischief and that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, did you... were you snapping photos at a young age? Were you drawing? Did you see yourself with an artistic bent?
No, absolutely nothing whatsoever. I mean, my thing was football. I was a football fanatic, and all I sort of thought about was football, and it was physical, always. I remember sort of, there used to be these shops near me, and you'd be sent to buy something in the shop, and you're just running all the time. It was, you know, it was very physical, always running. That's all I remember as a kid, was running all the time. Everything, everywhere was. I never walked. I always ran, you know. And I think everyone around me was the same. It was the same way. It was an incredible energy. I just this is all pretty very rose tinted, and you know, looking back on your childhood, but I just seemed to be running all the time. Very physical, you know. Very, very conscious of being healthy and fit, and didn't really have any artistic bents. But I mean, you know, in Ireland, it's like everyone's talking and telling stories, and I think it's almost an instinctive thing that we there's an artistic vein in everyone, and it comes out in different ways.
So did you mentioned stories, and you're a storyteller, you know, visually and in particular with the collected images in a film. Is that something you picked up that entire time, the stories you heard and your connection to the environment and talking and conversation as a way to drive
reading,
that?
And reading. Oh, sorry. That's a phone that normally never rings for some reason. I bet it's a sales call or some ambulance chasing lawyer.
Perfectly fine.
I mean, not consciously. I mean, I just think, you know, we know. I think, you know, I grew up in a generation of in Ireland when art and anything like that was, largely seen as probably being very pretentious, and you know, you were very kind of full of yourself if you called yourself an artist. And yet, you know, we all loved music, we all loved to read. I just think it was we were less conscious of that kind of stuff, you know. We weren't, you know, these days everyone's an artist, and we appreciate things far more, and we've got deeper feelings for things. Or at least we tell ourselves that, but not consciously. No, not consciously. An artist.
Well, but now you are. So why do you feel that you create now? I mean, was all of a sudden there was a drive to capture what you were seeing, what you were hearing?
I think in school, you know, writing probably from early teens, I discovered that I really enjoyed writing, and I did quite well at it. In fact, probably one of the only subjects I did well in was English, you know, and English literature and writing, and essay writing. So, I guess that was the beginning of understanding that, expressing yourself beyond just telling stories and playing football and doing the kind of, you know, the prosaic stuff of an Irish childhood. Yeah, not consciously so, but anyway, yeah, English and reading and books, and I wanted to become a journalist. I think that then was the thing that drove me, you know, as I was, you know, heading towards leaving school and what I was going to do with either studying or education. I thought about becoming a journalist, and I tried to get into the journalism school in Dublin, and I didn't get in because I think someone told me that, well, you know, you're supposed to have had written stuff for a local newspaper, and even if it meant going to a football match and taking down the scores, you know, and parents, I guess, that were pushy and understood this were encouraging the kids to do that. Mine didn't. They kind of let us get on with things. And I didn't get into the journalism college, but I got into something probably far more interesting, which was the first communications course that was set up in Dublin. And by doing that, I got introduced to cameras. And radio, and it was a very general course, but it opened up a world that I didn't really, I wasn't aware of before, which was the camera and using the camera for that kind of stuff. I found myself after college in America, and I lived for a while in San Francisco, and there was a public darkroom down the street from where I was living, and I went and sort of joined up there and started printing my pictures. And I think that's where it really took off, you know, where you could take a photograph, shoot a roll of film and then go and print it and see the results. And I learned so much from that. And so that was how I got introduced to cameras.
So you take your camera. I mean, you've traveled, for the listeners, I mean, you've traveled to a lot of locations around the world, including, those in conflict, in war. And when you've done that, are you trying to capture what you see? Are you trying to document, or
yes,
what are you trying to express?
Yes. I mean, it's certainly initially, you know, when I started doing that work, which was, I was interested in journalism. I was never attracted to war or war reporting. It wasn't something that, you know, I was particularly motivated, you know, to get into journalism and become a photographer. You know, that came later. But I started learning the craft, and eventually I started getting work and getting some newspaper work in London. I was living in London at the time. And I guess I was beginning to sort of, yes, I was beginning to sort of, you know, read reports of stuff happening in other places. And Afghanistan was somewhere that my eldest sister had been to on the hippie trail, you know, and she used to say that actually Afghanistan, of all the places that she went to, was the most fascinating and the most unexpected. And, you know, I just heard all these amazing stories about this country. And of course, there was this, you know, after she'd been there, there'd been, you know, the Soviet invasion and all the things, you know, all the stories that happened, all the stuff that happened to Afghanistan became a particularly interesting place. And I had the opportunity to go there in 94. And, you know, that was my baptism of fire when it came to conflict. Suddenly I was, actually the year before I'd been to Eritrea, the war was over, but there was a referendum, but I spent a month there, and it was a very interesting time because they'd had 30 years of war, Eritrea and Ethiopia, and
right.
It was a country post-conflict, and I was suddenly understanding, my God, you know, when a war goes on, these things happen, and then you start realizing all the consequences and talking to people about their experiences and, you know, seeing people walking around with limbless and being introduced to concepts like landmines and, you know, people standing on mines. And, you know, it was a whole world that I hadn't really given a lot of thought to. And the idea that, you know, society and is ripped apart and people's lives are so deeply affected and there's physical scars that you see. And that intrigued me. And I came back to London after that trip. And as I say, fairly shortly afterwards, I had the opportunity to go to Afghanistan, and I jumped at it because it was a combination of this exposure to this post-conflict world, but also my sister, you know, who had told me all about that extraordinary country. And so it was a combination of things. So I went to Afghanistan. Really, I wanted to experience the country and report back what I was seeing, because I before I went, I learned that it was like a forgotten war, and that although the Soviets had withdrawn in 89, this was 94. Actually, the country was more at war than it ever was, you know, since. And yet everyone thought the war was over. The Russians had left. You know, it must be peaceful, and it was a forgotten right. war. So I wanted to see that, and I wanted to try and show that. And bring that back. And so it was very journalistic. I wasn't thinking about art. I wasn't thinking about aesthetics so much. I was really thinking about, you know, performing the work of a journalist. And I went with a writer who was a journalist, and it was for a newspaper. So it was very much a photojournalistic trip.
And so do you see yourself having transitioned from that? So, I mean, I'm the viewer. Like, if I take a look at, you know, your book in the images with Eliza Griswold, right? And you have your photography there, and both of your collaborations are with, you know, they contain poetry that's connected to it, the other one with Polly Jean Harvey. Do you feel, I see your images as poetic. I see as these two things working back and forth between each other. And in my mind, it feels deliberate that the language that is being used and connected to your photos, I think it's important that it is poetry, and that the land eyes in kind of short pieces. Is that something that... So I'm talking about your images. Did you feel like if words were going to be next to your images, that they would be of that form, of a poetic
form?
Well,
the funny thing is, I mean, I do see the work as poetic, you know, and the funny thing is that Darkness Visible, that book, and I think there's probably images, there certainly could be images in the Land Eye book, and also the book with Polly, the Hollow of the Hand, that were taken on that very first trip in 94. Now, I was going with a journalistic cap on. I wasn't thinking about poetry. I wasn't thinking about art. But I did get pictures that I see now as being very poetic. And I think also the country inspired me. You know, it was incredibly, incredibly saturated with color, and yet I was shooting black and white. On that first trip, mostly I did shoot some color, but I was shooting black and white, and I think that probably helped too, because there was an abstraction to it, and I was thinking in black and white. But I am very conscious that my work is poetic, I strive for that now. I mean, I absolutely, you know, I embrace that. But on that first trip, if you'd asked me, like, is your work poetic? I would have thought, you know, no, I'm being a journalist. But in actual fact, I did seem to achieve some kind of poetic imagery, and I guess, you know, I did that, and I look at the work, and I would have come back to London after that Afghan trip, and I would have, you know, gone back to working for newspapers in London. I used to work for a Swedish newspaper as well. And, you know, poetry was the last thing on my mind. But then the next time I went back to Afghanistan was 96. And I was again being a reporter, but the pictures I got were poetic. You know, it's sort of an instinctive thing, I think.
Yeah, and they're quite beautiful. I want to engage in a little bit of speculative. I'm maybe making a mistake of not having seen the piece of art that I'm going to talk about.
The film,
A Dog Called Money. But the question the question that came to mind, which was really fascinating to me, and I hope you can maybe shed a little light on it. You know, you're what I've read in the descriptions and seen the trailer and bits and pieces of it is that there's this dynamic that's going on with Polly Jean Harvey and the locations that she is in creating song and then going into the studio. At the same time, you're an artist. You're depicting her connection, between those two things. How do you create the art and what environments are creating it? So I see you both kind of, I imagine both of you like working in trying to describe that process or depict that process. On your side, what was it like to try to document another artist's process of creation?
Well, I wasn't, I certainly wasn't in the field. When it came to the Somerset House, the recording studio, which, I should explain also that was quite an interesting, unique experiment, which was she wanted to create almost like an installation, an art installation. And in the depths of this big old palace, the Somerset House, which is on the Thames in central London, inside a very, very large room, they built another smaller room, which had windows. And that structure was the recording studio. The area outside that studio was the bigger room, and an audience could come in and look through the windows at the process of the recording of the album. The people inside, the musicians and the producer and the technicians, couldn't see out. It was like a one-way glass. But the people on the outside could see in, and they could also hear what was being said, because everyone inside the room was wearing a lapel mic. So it was being broadcast outside. And so that was something I was allowed as the only person inside to film that and shoot that. So in that way, I was very consciously sort of recording the process. When I was in the field with Polly, I was going about my work and she was doing hers. We were setting out to do two things. Three things. One was to eventually, hopefully, have a book of her poetry and my pictures. The second thing was that she was writing what she was hoping was going to become an album. And the third thing I was doing was I was going to try and make a film of the whole collaboration. So I was just getting on with things. It was a bit of a struggle at times because on the one hand, I was trying to get good images still and moving. And because I was traveling with her and we're friends and we're both sort of quite private in ways, I didn't want to be kind of asking questions, and she wouldn't have been answering questions. So she's not that type. So I had to just go about my work, and she went about her work. And then every so often I would film her in these environments, but it wasn't a kind of a very conscious, thing of I am documenting this person writing her songs. You know, I was just going about my work and actually documenting. I did the same thing with the Landai book. I was documenting and photographing what I saw, and that would fit into the overall scheme. You know, with the Landais, which are poems, mostly written by women, but certainly they're sometimes written by men, but they're sort of written in the voice of a woman. It's a strange thing. But they're always describing women's lives. And as a photographer in Afghanistan, you know, especially a man photographer, male photographer, you're not supposed to photograph women. I mean, in traditional places. And if you're walking down the street and you're being seen photographing women, you'll get people, giving you a hard time. It might actually become quite dangerous. And it might even also endanger the woman, because it might be seen that even though she's not colluding any way, that she might be accused of looking for this attention from this photographer.
Sure.
Ever tried to photograph the women for that
for that project. I decided that, well, actually, I'm photographing what these women see. They're writing about what they see in their lives. So if I photograph Afghan life, then that's what they're seeing, either through their eyes or through the burqa, because some of them are wearing the burqa all the time. So it was a funny sort of position to be in. But in the end, I was just going about my work, and I just thought that with the film and with the books, you know, with editing and with layout and with structure, this is how the story will be told, and it'll be told in the voice of the woman. So, you know, the Landites, you're kind of seeing what the world, the Afghan world, through the woman's eyes. And I suppose with Hollow of the Hand and A Dog Called Mommy, it is the world seen through Polly's eyes and my eyes. It's a collaboration. In A Dog Called Money, because on one hand, we're looking at Afghanistan, Kosovo, Washington, D.C. We get to know certain characters in those places, their stories, their backgrounds. Then we see Polly sometimes interacting in those places, taking notes, talking to people. Then we hear her notebook that she's written. You know, I use as a voiceover her notes from her notebooks. I took out the sentences that I thought were kind of meaningful in certain contexts of the film. And it's literally the first thing that she wrote down in her notebooks. So sometimes with a song, she would re-edit that or, you know, discard a line, discard a word. What I've got as the voiceover in the film is directly, you know, the first thing that she, the first draft of history almost. You know, she's in Afghanistan with me. We're looking at something and she's putting it onto paper. And that's what you're hearing in the film. And then you go into Somerset House and you're part of the audience watching this process. Then at times I leave the inside sanctum and I go outside with the crowd and I look in and I'm seeing what those people see inside. So there's a lot of different, and you know, the film starts with, sorry you haven't seen it, but the film starts with a young boy staring through the windshield of the car that we're sitting in, and you're just seeing this very big close-up of this boy of about 8, 10 years of age looking straight at us. So there's a lot of things about reflection, observation, authorship, experience, witnessing, being conscious of this, voyeurism, you know, how we're voyeurs. I mean, she's got this great song called Dollar Dollar. And it describes how, you know, when we're sitting in the car in Kabul and you're at, you know, you're the traffic means you're not moving and the beggars are out. And this kid was begging, looking through the windscreen. And she talks about that horrible feeling you have when you're in that situation where you're trapped. You can't move. You can't really, you can close your eyes. That's about all you can do if you want to escape the gaze of somebody begging. And, you know, you've been told by people, don't pull down the window and give money because it'll create a crowd of kids will come and it'll be dangerous and all the rest of it. And that horrible feeling you have, helpless feeling. And she conveys it so well in that song. And so there's a voyeuristic aspect to well, all our lives. But you particularly feel it in places like Afghanistan where you are this outsider. And so there's lots of emotions going on. So, you know, that sounds very complicated and sounds very deep. Actually, I went and I did my work, you know. I got on with the work. You know, the ideas are there. The ideas will come in. The ideas came into play before we even left, the country to go traveling. But, you know, afterwards you gather the material and then you start making sense of it. I mean, I'm very much of the feeling that you know, when I'm working, I'm in another zone, and I'm sort of, you know, I'm just it's I'm not really thinking too deeply at the time I'm working. Afterwards, you know, you go into another state, and you're gathering, and you're later on you'll make sense of it.
Yeah, and I really appreciate your description of that. And, you know, part of the question is to you know, to really understand that. And, you know, I mean, you shared a lot there. I really appreciate the insight to the process. One of the things that really struck me with your images in, say, the poetry that was there is that it becomes quite apparent, particularly within the land eyes and in other situations, images and poetry, that folks, yourself, Polly Jean, other people you collaborate with, the folks who are in a war-torn country are engaging in art that could get them killed.
Yes.
That, you know, the land eyes are so incisive, so powerful, so short. They capture the reality in a nutshell, and they're amazing pieces. But what is apparent is that, you know, death is potentially all around, and there's significant risk in creating that art. And that feeling's palpable in both the images that you have in the poems themselves, is because I think, you know, even without it being described to you, that this is dangerous work.
Yeah, and I think it's also the environment. You know, like the place Afghanistan is. It's a beautiful place, and it's the people are extraordinarily hospitable and warm and generous. But it is quite dangerous, and it's quite it's a tough place. It's a tough life, and in fact, you know, the tradition and the religion, you know, of the land eyes it's Pashtun, and the Pashtun culture is very traditional and very fatalistic. I mean, you know, these poems are, you know, they sort of dismiss death, and they make fun of death, and it's a hard life, you know, that they're describing, and it really comes across, I think, in the work, you know, I mean, I suppose the thing that makes it easier and even possible at times for these women is that it's anonymous. You know, that they don't put their names to it. They don't reveal who wrote the pieces. And that's a form of protection. I mean, that's another reason, obviously, why I wouldn't be photographing, for example, the person who wrote this poem, because that would be revealing their identity, which could be very dangerous. But in the making of I'm the Beggar of the World, there was a group of women who ran a poetry society in Kabul, and you know, Kabul's a different matter. They're able to walk down the street with their head covered, but you know, they're not wearing burqas. In parts of the most of the rest of the country, that would not be possible. But there's slightly more opportunities for that in Kabul. But they ran a phone in where women could ring in with their poetry. You know, poetry is a huge thing in Afghanistan. And there was a story about this girl who was an incredible poet, and she was ringing from Helmand, which is a really remote and very traditional and very repressive part of Afghanistan. And you know, when she'd ring in, there was excitement in the studio with this group of women, because she was such a great poet, and she would be creeping out and borrowing her older sister's phone to make the phone call. And meanwhile, her brothers apparently were watching that she wasn't making phone calls to men. Very repressive situation. Anyway, in the end, this girl killed herself, and the story that we heard was that she was being forced to marry somebody that she didn't want to marry, but also her poetry was I think it was a problem. They found out she was writing poetry, which was seen as a sin, and so it's a really tough world, you know. It's a really tough world, and and they write about it, as you say, with such frankness and humor, but it's very black humor, you know. It's quite gallows humor.
Very dark humor, and in a, like I said, I think there are 22 syllables if I have it correct, and
that's
just,
right. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
they're just condensed, which. You know, which I think is an outcropping of, you know, you're not going to have, you know, John Milton tomes. You're going to have these kernels of the truth that they're experiencing. Seamus, I got a couple more abstract questions, away from, you know, the material of your work. And I ask all guests these, and I get some great answers. One of the big two is, what is art?
Art, I think, is it's many things, but it's life for sure. It's being critical. I think you can be poetic and still be very critical. I think it's appreciating what's around you. I think it's you know, it's shining a light on the stuff that makes life worthwhile. It makes you want to jump out of bed in the morning. It makes life civilized. It makes the winter bearable. I could go on.
Yeah. It makes the winter bearable. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And I love the variety of answers I get to that, because, you know, art is a driver for many of my guests, whether it's, you know, overtly creating pieces of art. And I've had, you know, musicians, you know, photographers, painters, hip hop artists within music. I just love hearing what that means for folks. I had mentioned that, you know, I've studied philosophy, and you know, I've studied that question for months, but then that didn't end. I kept kind of looking at that question and wondering, you know what it was. And another philosophical question, which of course is the title of the podcast, and I always give the opportunity to kind of answer this question in the context of, you know, creation, when you create something, or just in general, the general question, you know, in this world, why is there something rather than nothing?
Is there nothing? I don't think there's ever nothing. There's always something. I think the main thing is that something is something that's good. And I think if you can create something to fill the vacuum. Because if you create something and you are in control of that something, then that can be something good, you know, something beautiful, something interesting. The idea of nothing is I can't imagine that, actually. I can't imagine nothing. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if there was a sort of state of nothingness, then surely the first thing you do is, you do something to make something, you know, you'd do something to make it the way you want it. And I think that's actually another description of art, isn't it? We try to make the world the way we would like it to be, tell stories so that, you know, people learn things and behave better and, you know, make life better. I mean, I think art makes life better.
Yeah, Seamus. Couple more quick ones. You're around a lot of folks. You must encounter a lot of artists. Who else would you like to hear answer these questions?
Who else would I like to hear answer these questions? My mother. she's no longer with us, but I'd love to hear what she has to say about these things.
Yeah.
Who else?
Did your mom love art?
She did. She did. You know, she painted a little bit. She read a lot. I think she gave me some kind of sense of aesthetic, which I think is you know, it's apparent in my work. So I think I owe her a lot. Yeah. Yeah.
And finally, you know, and this is for you. Is there anything you can let listeners know about how to, you know, encounter your art? I know you have a website which contains the videos, including all the videos for Let England Shake and some of your shorter videos. I believe one or two might have been shown on the BBC. And
there's something that was in the New Yorker. I did a film, short film, a couple of short films for the New Yorker. Actually, one was during the London Olympics in 2012. They got in touch with me and said, you know, would you like to do a film on the Olympics, but don't go to the Olympics. Just do London during the Olympics. So that was an interesting project. That's on the New Yorker site. It's called Went the Games Well. Another film which I did for the New Yorker is called Home is Another Place, which is a short film about my return to Dublin on the 50th anniversary of the death of JFK. Because I actually saw JFK when he visited Dublin, visited Ireland in 1963, a few months before he was assassinated. And so I combined that memory of seeing John F. Kennedy in Dublin as a three-year-old boy, must be my first memory, with my own return to Ireland, having not lived there for years. And so that's on the New Yorker site. Yeah, and as you say, on my own website, SeamusMurphy.com, SeamusMurphy.com, there's films and there's photographs. And then there's the books, A Darkness Visible, Afghanistan, The Hollow of the Hand, I Am the Beggar of the World, and The Republic.
Yeah, and it just really beautiful works. And I'm hoping to track down A Dog Called Money. I know it's shown at, and of course that's, you know, your newer film. I know it's shown at a couple, you know, kind of independent film fests over here in the United States. And it's been released.
It's getting a release in the UK November the 1st. It gets a UK release all over the country, and there's a number of venues in London, and then in Ireland, Republic of Ireland, it opens later in October, in November. Germany, I think it's got a limited release. It's slowly getting there, and it's doing some festivals. I mean, I've done all the major festivals. I'm off to Vienna tomorrow for the Viennale, and then I go to China in December for a festival in Beijing. And it'll be out then on DVD, Blu-ray. I think in December it's out on that release.
I very much look forward to it. And I got to tell you, Seamus, it's really been a thrill to talk to you. And I deeply appreciate your time. You know, spending some time on the podcast with these questions. That
My pleasure.
That I've enjoyed talking to you, and I really love the work, and I felt propelled to contact you. And I just, again, deep thanks for me, but also everybody that'll listen to, just to hear you know, about your works and about your process. And I really look forward to your incredible images and in films to come. So just really wanted to give you a deep thanks, Seamus, for spending time.
Thank you very much.
You have a great evening, and thanks again.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing.